This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. August 7th, 2015. It was a Friday that seemed like the beginning of any other summer weekend. But as the evening approached, sickening news of an event in downtown Barrie sped throughout the state. Lara Sobel, a social worker with the Department for Children and Families, was leaving her office at Barrie City Place and was ambushed by a woman with a gun. The alleged shooter, Jody Herring, had a custody dispute with DCF that motivated her to kill Lara Sobel nearly a year ago. The state has charged Herring with first-degree murder in Sobel's death. Herring has pleaded not guilty. As that weekend unfolded, police also found the bodies of three more people, relatives of Herring's, whom she also allegedly murdered. She has pleaded not guilty to aggravated murder in those cases. A premeditated murder carried out in broad daylight is a horrifying and brazen act. Reaction to Sobel's death was compounded by the circumstances surrounding the crime. She was allegedly targeted because of her work on difficult cases of child custody. She was a state employee leaving her office at the end of the workday. And according to coworkers and friends, she was a dedicated public servant, the kind of person they say you'd want involved in protecting vulnerable kids. The loss to Sobel's family and friends is understandably profound, but her death has had an impact far beyond the personal. It has prompted changes in security measures and heightened the awareness and concern for the safety of some state workers. It's also left a lasting impression on the people who were witnesses that day. Among them was Scott Williams, the Washington County State's attorney. Had the events unfolded differently, Williams could or would be prosecuting Jody Herring in Sobel's murder. But Williams happened to be nearby that day and was one of several people who intervened after hearing gunshots. He's a witness in the state's case against Herring. He joins us today to talk about how the murder of Lara Sobel has reverberated at the Washington County State's Attorney's Office, in the state agencies they work with, and throughout the larger community of central Vermont. It's also impacted him personally and given him fresh perspective on how people and communities recover from trauma. Scott Williams, I appreciate you being here. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Why were you nearby that day?
I was actually receiving physical therapy at the rehab gym, which is in the building that DCF was in at that time.
And can you describe your actions when you realized that something was going on?
Yeah. I can't speak in any detail because there's pending criminal charges. But I was 12 feet away but behind a wall from where the shooting happened. When the first shot went off, I started to head toward the door.
You recognized it as gunfire?
Yeah. I said, somebody call 911, and then I went out the door. And at that time, I didn't know who was involved, and then I intervened.
You actually recognized and knew both women involved in this, Jody Herring, the alleged shooter, and Lara Sobel, who was killed. What did it feel like to realize you had a connection to the people?
When it was going down, it didn't register. I knew that I was recognizing both of them, but it didn't register. It didn't carry any significance. As the evening wore on, it started to sort of, again, to register what all had happened. You know, I had known Lara for a decade at that point. Miss Herring, I had known, not well, but I did know her.
Through court proceedings?
Again, I'd rather not even say that. I had interacted with her in the past, and I knew her by name.
Does that make a difference to you now in thinking about the event, that you had this connection to the participants?
It certainly would have been great if I had known that this level of anger was existing. I can't say that I could have diffused things, but I certainly would have been willing to take a shot at it.
I don't want to go into too much detail, and I know that you also don't, Scott Williams, about the actual moments after the shooting and your actions. It's been reported that you took the gun away from Jody Herring, and you were there on the scene very quickly. I'm curious, though, if this is something that replays in your head that you think about a lot. It's only been a year.
No. And for me, the reason is that I plugged right back into doing trauma work. I had finished, a round of trauma therapy from my military days a couple of years before the shooting. And so I literally was
personal therapy, like you'd been seeing a therapist.
Yeah. And so I was able to literally plug back in immediately. You know, it's different for people. Everyone has a different experience of it. You know, I would have things like, you know, for a period of about 3 months, there was like a slide image that would show up in sort of the corner of my vision, which is could be pretty, you know, kind of disconcerting because you're literally seeing almost a photograph that doesn't go away. But I didn't have the intrusive thoughts, and it didn't, for the very most part, it didn't, you know, I didn't have those heightened responses. I had some responses, you know, no question about that, but I didn't have the heightened responses. My vigilance went back up. It never reached the level of hypervigilance, but I did go back for a while to, you know, not liking going out in public. If I was in public, I was sitting with my back to a wall. My family helped me get back out of that habit. So
it doesn't replay in your head, but it sounds like it's something that you think about a lot. Not necessarily the events in those moments, but what they represent and how to move forward. Because this is something that on the anniversary of the shooting and of Lara Sobel's death, you've been thinking about and wanting to be able to talk about. Why?
So it's for me, it's not that I want to talk about Lara's death. It does provide an opportunity. And again, I didn't know Lara well as long as I'd known her, but I certainly don't think she would disapprove of the ability to have a discussion about the bigger issues. You know, the bigger issues of violence. Like that was not just Lara's murder, but the three relatives as well. And that's a factor of whatever infinity different from what we are used to in Vermont, and it changed people's perspectives, mostly for the better, some for the worse. So that's for me. That's why I don't spend much time in therapeutically. It's good thinking about what happened on August 7th. It's there. It's with me. You know, it pops up at random moments. Usually in a way that if you were speaking about it, if I explained to you, well, it popped up this way, one would go, huh? You know, you wouldn't really why, and I don't know why.
Just odd moments where it wouldn't.
A piece of music that I've heard a million times for some reason makes me want to cry, you know. But it's not that I think about it. I don't think that it's would be good for me to think about it. So that's... You know, that's kind of where it's at.
We're talking with Washington County State's Attorney Scott Williams. He was involved in the aftermath of the fatal shooting last year of DCF social worker Lara Sobel. He's sharing his perspective on how these events have changed the communities that he's a part of, and that's what we're going to get into next, and these changing perceptions and, in some cases, changing policies. So In the immediate aftermath of the shooting, there were a lot of questions that were raised about how safe or unsafe the job of a social worker is for employees at the Department for Children and Families, how often they feel threatened, how much security support they have, and do they have it when and if they need it, how many resources they have, do they feel like they have enough resources. Have you seen any changes in those situations in the past year?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. First, just on the level of the folks that do the work, there has been a lot of understandable, I'll describe it as anxiety, around safety. And I think that that's really understandable. At the time, and I can only really speak for Washington County, DCF was in what I consider an unsecured space. They were in the One City Place, and they, they were not protected. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing, because at the time, while conceptually people were aware of a potential for violence, you know, that was the status quo. DCF has since moved back into the courthouse, which is where we are in Barrie, and the court is. So there is definitely security there. you know, one of the first interactions I had with DCF folks after the shooting was to go over and say, you know, I really want to encourage you all not to live in fear. You know, live with caution, which is something I've been doing since I was 19. But don't live in fear. I think some people still have fear, and that's okay. But I also think that the perception I have is that a lot of people don't feel really heard about the issues of security. I feel that I have not been heard about issues of security, and I'm honestly not worried for my personal safety. You'd have to be pretty good to get me. But I have people that work for me, and I have people that work around me that I care about and worry about, and I don't feel that the state has been all that responsive to those concerns.
Yeah, when you say you don't feel like you've been heard by the state, who?
The administration, you know, the governor's office, you know, the human resources, buildings and grounds, you know, there's a lot of good people, well-intended people. I think that as with a lot of things that I'm frustrated about, you know, I've never been in government. I've never been elected. I find government bureaucracy incredibly frustrating. You know, we should be able to get things done that need to get done. There is money in other pots that can be moved if someone is willing to make the effort to move it. And if it's for the right cause, that should happen. And I have not felt that that's been happening.
Do you have specifics on what you think would help the security measures or help people feel more safe?
You know, one of the things that I said very shortly after was, you know, we have these wide open parking lots. So even if I'm in a bulletproof building, I step out the door and there's nothing. There's no night watchman. There's no rent-a-cop. There's no fence. There's no nothing. I heard on more than one occasion, if we do it there, we have to do it everywhere. My feeling is, well, guess what? We had someone get killed in your parking lot. I think maybe we should consider doing it everywhere. You know, we have other security issues up in Grand Isle. The state's attorney up there is a one-person show, and he's in a house that sits 15 feet off the street, and the access to his building is into his office, like where he's sitting, and there's no one, period, between him and there's no thing between him and whoever comes in. And I've said repeatedly, you know, people can come to my office, they can come be seen through a secure space, but we can see them, we can interact with them, and we can meet with them. You can show up. You don't need special permission or a pass, and you can get to a place where you can interact with us. I think that's appropriate. We are the public servants, but it has to be in a way that allows those of us that are under some level of threat at this point to have some safety.
You know, there's also what you mentioned, perceptions of threats. Mm-hmm. And I imagine for people who worked with Lara Sobel, this was shocking and terrible and felt very personal and felt like a personal loss, but can also feel very personal if you have a similar job and you feel this threat, maybe even an existential threat. How have you observed people dealing with their perceptions of their own personal and professional safety?
I can speak to what goes on within my office. You know, we have one person that works for me in particular who really, I don't think struggled isn't the right word because it would possibly denote weakness, but dealt with real fear about their safety. And ultimately, you know, there's not what I said is ultimately there's not an answer that someone else can give you. You have to figure out whether it's worth it, right? I mean, if this position in this location and this reality causes that for you, you should think about doing something different. Not because I disapprove or think you're weak or anything, but simply you have to take care of yourself. I certainly hope that, you know, within the Department of Children and Families, that folks have been doing that. You know, there are a small cadre of social workers that I see regularly and chat with. This doesn't come up a lot, but, you know, what I have certainly said to them is, look, you can always come, you can always call me, you can always see me. I know the deputies will always be available. You know, sometimes we walk people out to the parking lot. You know, we had a case not very long ago where an individual had made statements about intending to kill some folks and had then taken steps to acquire a gun. You know, we had state police on site. We had deputy sheriffs on site. I escorted several of my – well, I made my people go out escorted and ended up not being anything we really needed to worry about. But I wasn't going to take that risk.
Right after the shootings, Governor Shumlin made a point of saying frequently and in several news outlets that he was really alarmed by the negative and threatening rhetoric he saw directed at DCF workers and in some cases other state workers, mostly online, mostly in sort of response forums. Do you see that? Have there been any changes in tone in the past year, for better or for worse?
There was a definite spike in the couple of months after. I could not fathom some of the stuff that I read.
Spike in negative comments.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there was also a spike in threatening behavior of various types. One day one of my deputies came back from court because someone had, after they'd come out of the court, made some comments to the effect of, you know, if this is the way it's going to go, I should go back home and get my rifle and yada, yada, yada. And I went and confronted that person who I knew. And I basically said, you know, do you know who I am? Do you know what I did, you know, 2 months ago? Do you really think that this is appropriate? And, I grew up poor in Bennington, so I can kind of connect with people sometimes that maybe others that are lawyers can't. And I just said, you know, not in my house. This isn't how this goes. So we can go one of two ways. I can probably charge you, or – you know, can you get your head straight? And that person apologized and was able to process what I was saying. And that's all it was. It was inappropriate talk given the circumstances. It wasn't prior to the shooting. It wouldn't necessarily have been that inappropriate because there wouldn't have been a reference point for it.
Again, today we're talking with Scott Williams. He's Washington County State's attorney, and he was involved in the aftermath of the fatal shooting last year of DCF social worker Lara Sobel. The anniversary of that death is coming up on August 7th. Scott's sharing his perspective on how these events have changed him and his perceptions and also the communities he's a part of. More to come on that. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're spending some time with Washington County State's Attorney Scott Williams. He's reflecting on the events he witnessed and was a part of on August 7th of last year when DCF social worker Lara Sobel was killed, allegedly by a woman named Jody Herring, who was upset about her child custody case, which Sobel was a part of. Williams was telling us a little bit about how the past year has changed things for him and for state workers in Barrie. We're going to talk as well a little bit about the community and what kinds of work still needs to be done. You can share your perspective with us on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Scott Williams, has your personal experience with this event changed your professional approach to the job of Washington County State's attorney? You hadn't been in the job for that long when this happened.
No, I'd been in just 6 months. I think the answer is no. I came in knowing a lot of people across a broad spectrum of the community. And I interact with people as people. You can have the longest criminal record in the world and you're still a person. You're still a member of our community. And we're both and all, I think, going to benefit from me treating you like the person that you are as opposed to the case that you might be. Doesn't mean people aren't held accountable. It doesn't mean people don't sometimes get incarcerated. People are going to come back to the community and they are people. So in terms of the approach that my office takes to our strictest interpretation of the job, which is looking at and prosecuting crime, it hasn't changed how we do business. The issues are more around now what happens outside of the building, and that's a safety issue. And you know, I do still have concerns about in the you know they're the chances of something like it happening are remote. But you know, we had the shooting in Florida at the nightclub, and now we've had another one, evidently. You know, there's a first layer of defense, which is our deputy sheriffs in the building, and then that's it. And I would prefer that we have a more hardened physical space.
You said that you treat people as people, not as cases. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you had dealt with trauma in your past and had gone to therapy for it. I'm curious a little bit about how you see trauma reflected in the cases that come through the courthouse in Washington County, because it seems like from my reporting in courthouses, there is often a lot of underlying trauma involved in criminal activity. And having experienced trauma yourself and seeing what you see in the courthouse, what's your perspective on that?
So, you know, and to those who might think that discussing trauma histories in criminal defendants is somehow an excuse for behavior, it's not. But it certainly does provide it with a context. And I know how my brain functioned for a long time as a result of trauma. One of the things – well, the two primary ones were hypervigilance and anger. So, you know, if I'm hypervigilant and angry all the time and then you pile on lack of job opportunities, lack of education, probably a family history of addiction, mental health, trauma, et cetera, there's a decent chance that I'm going to have a different set of values than I now have. And that has an impact on how people act. You know, I would say, you know, I mean, with the drug crime, I think about 70% of our criminal caseload now is pretty directly driven by drugs. Trauma is probably, and I'm guesstimating here, but probably in the 45% range. And look, you don't need to have experienced what I experienced on August 7th to have suffered trauma. You know, you don't even have to have been there to have been trauma. That was a hard lesson for me to learn, that you cannot have even been present and still actually experience trauma symptoms, because that sounded kind of, I don't know, seemed kind of weak to me, quite honestly, but I understand it now. So if you've lived that life and your body's functioning that way, you know, your limbic brain is firing all the time and dumping, you know, cortisol and adrenaline into your system, it impacts you. And it certainly facilitates or can facilitate criminal behavior, lack of empathy, you know, that sort of thing. So that's what I see.
And what do you see then as how to deal with that? If that's driving some of the behaviors or some of the reactions or some of the actions that people take and maybe not leading them into crime but being a factor in criminal activity, how do we deal with that, or how should we be dealing with that?
Well, you know, it's a resource issue. I was fortunate, again, and I feel very fortunate about a lot of this stuff, that I – got plugged into a Veterans Administration trained therapist who could say, hey, there's a point, there's a starting point and there's an ending point, and you're going to feel a heck of a lot better. The work is going to stink. It's going to be rough. You know, I took her at her word. We did the work and I said, hey, this works. And there are a lot of people that are trying to do work and trying to help people with trauma. You know, I don't know necessarily how effective some of it may be. But the idea that my dream world as the state's attorney in Washington County would be that I could have every person who commits crime and comes through our courthouse could be assessed for a trauma background and potentially receive therapy related to that trauma, because it plays such a big role. You know, because of a trauma history, you don't have an ability to empathize with people very well. thereby you can't really appreciate how your acts harm others, you're not exactly a productive citizen. And I would love to have more people being productive citizens, with a criminal record or not. So,
do you see that perspective growing in the criminal justice system? It seems like it's a part of some intervention programs and diversion programs now. Therapy is a big part of many of those, and an acknowledgement that there may be trauma involved in drug use or crime. You recognize it, but partly because you have personal experience with it. Do you think others in the system are recognizing this, and are things changing?
Yeah, no, folks are definitely recognizing it. You know, how we deal with it, getting the right level of expertise in to have us really understand it, and then how do we integrate it into what we do? You know, there's a balancing act that I have to do all the time, which is like, where does my job, how far out into the community does my job reach? If people are willing to hear from me, I think it reaches as far as people are willing to hear from me. Certainly, it resides in the courthouse. In order to have it be addressed within the court system, we need, again, we go back to needing resources. You know, and I'll just say, this will be the one pitch that I make today. You know, with five lawyers in my office in 2015, we did 2,643 cases total. You know, it's 600 plus cases each. It's kind of hard to really get a handle on where any individual is when you're triaging everything all the time. And we could certainly do a better job if we had the ability to spend some time looking at who the people are, and seeing whether there's a better fit.
Well, and I suppose the larger question, too, is how do you address issues like this before they reach the level of the criminal justice system and before they reach lawyers and court cases?
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's where diversions, restorative justice centers, those sorts of things, when run well, you know, and where there's buy-in from the community. You know, I can give you a very brief example. It's not trauma. Well, it may or may not have trauma background, but Montpelier Police have Operation Safe Catch, where they can elect to offer treatment with the potential of a case not being charged. And I had a Montpelier officer come to just check in with me about where he perceived of a case going. You know, 17-year-old doing 4 bags of heroin a day by nose. Yeah, we needed to help that kid, right? That kid had also been involved in a burglary, maybe a couple of burglaries. But yeah, let's get that treated. And if the motivation, if part of the motivation for the treatment is that I maybe can avoid the court system, I'm okay with that as long as we have adequate monitoring.
In terms of reaching out into the community and what you're seeing, you know, this event that sparked this conversation and, you know, that has had such reverberations, the killing of Lara Sobel, what are you seeing in central Vermont and in Barrie in general, and you know, in terms of what kind of community work needs to be done to help heal the scars of this event?
You know, it's interesting. Tom Lozon, who's the mayor down in Barrie, he did a thing, and I can't remember when it was, but he gave me and a couple of other folks a straw hat that, which when I heard about it, struck me as a little strange. But Lara was this hat person. If you see photos that people have put out, she's usually got a hat on, and it's usually one of these – I don't even know what you call them, these straw hats.
Like a sun hat.
Yes. You know. So, you know, I have a Lara sun hat. It sits in my office. I see it every day. And, you know, there was a small event in downtown Barrie to do that and to sort of commemorate that. You know, DCF has definitely done a number of events. There were several groups of us that for the corporate cup that wore Lara themed shirts. But, you know, healing can be – I think this is just me speaking. I think healing can be facilitated by public acts. I've never been that into the public acts myself. You know, that's just me. I think some people do need it, but we certainly see, you know, The candle vigils and those kinds of things, I think they're very valuable for some people, and there have certainly been a number of them. So,
we got a note from Chris who says, when I saw the headline in the Burlington Free Press a year ago, I said, I'm going to know this person because I work with social workers all the time to help my patients keep their families together and to make sure that children are living in safe homes. I was even more shocked, Chris writes, when I read the article and realized it was Lara, with whom I went to UVM and who was a living, loving example of the very best of DCF. After the shock wore off and the sadness settled in, I also recognized fear for all of us on the front lines of trying to take care of families in Vermont and everywhere. And Chris says, thank you very much, Scott, for your courage that day and your continued courage to do the work you do. Before we let you go, what about, you mentioned earlier that you don't feel like you and others are being heard by the state in terms of security and safety and other concerns that you have. What else should or could the state be doing to address those?
Well, in the short term, sometimes just to allow your folks to feel heard, you might need to spend a little money on things that may end up being token, but certainly are important.
Like what?
I wanted our interaction window to be bulletproof. It was under $1,000 to put in a bulletproof window. That was a struggle. The risks are pretty low that somebody's going to get in the building, but they don't exist. So things like that, I wanted to get a radio so that we could be involved in the, if there is ever an active shooter event, that we can hear what's going on because I can take care of my people as long as I know what's happening. And that, I am getting a radio, but it's a donation from another police department, things like that.
Scott Williams is the Washington County State's attorney. I want to thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
August 7th is the anniversary of Lara Sobel's death, and we've been talking a little bit about what Scott Williams experienced then and how that event has reverberated around the community in Barrie and beyond. Coming up, we'll be joined by VPR's Peter Hirschfeld for an update from Philadelphia on the Democratic National Convention. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the Republican establishment gathered to officially nominate a candidate for president, Donald Trump. Now it's the Democrats' turn to hash out the party platform and nominate their candidate. Yesterday was the first day of the convention and the first night of high-profile speeches, and there were some fireworks. Here to fill us in on the details of what he's been experiencing is VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. Hi, Pete. Nice to talk with you.
Hey, good to talk with you, Jane.
Vermont has 16 pledged delegates. Remind us how they break down in their votes.
Since Bernie Sanders won more than 85% of the vote in Vermont, state election rules mean he's going to walk away with the entirety of its pledged delegates. So when it came time to elect those pledged delegates at the state-level convention back in May, it was an overwhelmingly pro-Sanders contingent seeking those delegate seats. And as a result, the Vermont delegation here in Philadelphia is, to a person, a Sanders supporter, among the pledged delegates at least. Vermont has 10 superdelegates, four of which were behind Hillary Clinton and have been from the get-go.
Pete, what are Vermonters saying about some of the speeches last night? We heard from Elizabeth Warren, we heard from Michelle Obama, and what at least the Vermont delegation was probably most excited about, we heard from Bernie Sanders.
The big talking point for a lot of delegates is whether or not to heed the plea that Bernie issued last night to shift their support to Hillary Clinton now that the nomination is hers. And there are a lot of folks that just aren't there. There was an undeniable passion to the support that gave rise to Sanders' campaign, and you're seeing that intensity now cut another way. And now that Bernie is not going to be the nominee, this pro-Sanders passion is in some cases turning into a really strong anti-Clinton sentiment. Bernie supporters have a range of grievances, be it trade policy, corporate contributions, and super PACs that Clinton has relied on for her campaign, or her jabs at Bernie earlier in the campaign for saying things like Medicare for all were a far-fetched fantasy. They also say that until Hillary Clinton demonstrates a more genuine commitment to the progressive planks of Bernie Sanders' platform, they're going to withhold their support. Here's Noah Detzer. He's a young man from the Upper Valley.
We're suggested to just get in line. And don't get me wrong, I do believe that we share a lot of the ideals with the Hillary Clinton campaign. But there are some serious issues of trust and integrity.
For a lot of Sanders supporters, this election is going to be about fighting this industrial political machine that they think has taken control of government from the people that it was created to support. And a lot of them still very much feel like Hillary Clinton is a big part of that machine.
You say a lot of them feel that way, Pete, but does that sort of represent the Vermont delegation in general, or are you seeing and feeling a split?
I have yet to find a Vermont delegate who's willing to issue a fawning endorsement of Hillary Clinton, but there are plenty of them who are ready to vote for her. And there are others who say that making sure she wins against Donald Trump is the most critical next step in perpetuating what they really believe can be a progressive revolution that Bernie Sanders started. Many of them are simply taking their lead from Bernie Sanders himself. And when he spoke on the convention floor last night, he beseech people to be with her now. And that hit home for some of them. Here's Astor O'Leary. She's an 18-year-old Hinesburg teenager who, as you can probably imagine, is the youngest delegate from Vermont.
I was kind of on the fence. Like, I was going back and forth between, like, maybe being Bernie or bus or, like, supporting Hillary. But after hearing what Bernie had to say yesterday, I'm going to feel less, you know, guilty to support Hillary.
I've talked to some other delegates as well who say they've followed Bernie this far and they're going to take his lead on this front as well. For a lot of them, it isn't about supporting Hillary Clinton per se. It's about averting what they think would be really a catastrophic presidency under Donald Trump. And they want to do everything they can to keep the political ground as fertile as it can possibly be for the kind of platform that Bernie Sanders has been pushing and that he vows to continue pushing.
Pete, do you think the Democratic Party is surprised by the pull that Senator Sanders continues to have with many of his delegates and many of his supporters who aren't at the convention, who, you know, he has this ability to say, this is what I'm thinking. And people like Astor O'Leary are saying, well, I'm taking my cues from him, not, you know, he's out and I'm going to take my cues from wherever my personal choice feels right. I mean, they're still listening to what Bernie Sanders has to say. Do you think the Democrats are aware of how strong his pull remains?
I don't think that they're surprised. I think they long ago learned to stop being surprised by how much resonance Bernie Sanders' message has proven to have with millions of American voters. Keep in mind that 13 million Americans voted for Bernie Sanders. It wasn't just people in Vermont who fell in line behind him. The Clinton campaign's press secretary was talking to the Vermont delegation at a breakfast here in a cluster of chain motels outside of downtown Philadelphia where the delegation is staying. And he talked about the early days of the campaign when Robbie Mook, campaign manager for Hillary Clinton, told them during a meeting, I'm from Vermont. I've seen Bernie Sanders operate. And this guy is going to be a force to be reckoned with. And that was before Bernie Sanders started making his stand in the polls. It was before he started winning primaries. So I think they know they've got a real phenomenon on their hands. It isn't going to go away just because Hillary Clinton is now the nominee.
Pete, you mentioned these breakfasts, and we heard last week from John Dillon, who was at the RNC, that their delegates are of all states are treated to these guest speakers at breakfasts every day. What else have they been up to? What's the Vermont delegation doing at the Democratic National Convention?
Well, very similar. There's a group breakfast for delegates here every morning at 7:30 sharp. Vermont is in the same cluster of hotels as Maine and New Hampshire, and all the delegates from those states get together for this. There was a keynote address this morning from Howard Dean. He talked for about 15 minutes, and he thanked the mostly pro-Bernie crowd. New Hampshire and Maine went heavily for Bernie as well, for what they've done to move Bernie's platform forward. Dean, of course, ran for president in 2004, and his candidacy was at the time viewed as a progressive insurgency. But Dean's a Clinton guy, and he has been from the beginning. In addition to praising Bernie Sanders' contributions to the national dialogue this morning, he also offered some thoughts on why Hillary Clinton is well-positioned to now lead that, quote, revolution. Some of the delegates appreciated the sentiment. They seem on board with his mode of thinking and the rightness of using Hillary Clinton to move Bernie Sanders' ideas forward. Others, though, really made no effort to veil their contempt and disgust for what he was saying. They got up and they asked him. They said, if Hillary's against the big banks, why didn't she try to break them up after she voted for the bailout? If Hillary is against corporate money in politics, why does she take so much of it? Howard Dean tried to address that criticism, but it was abundantly clear that a lot of people just aren't ready to hear it.
Pete, in just the couple seconds we have left, roll call tonight, big roll for the delegates. What's on tap?
Bill Clinton will be in the House for one. He's going to detail his wife's long history of hard work and activism on behalf of the Democratic Party. But there's a roll call vote, too. We're going to get an official nominee tonight. Hillary Clinton will be named the Democratic candidate. And it'll be interesting to see what sort of impact that has on the mindset of Sanders supporters.
That's VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. He's in Philadelphia this week covering the DNC and the Vermont delegation. Pete, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
Funding for VPR's reporting from the presidential conventions is made possible in part by the VPR Journalism Fund. And now we turn to your comments from recent programs. Joining me to read a few of them is Vermont Edition producer Rick Sangari. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Jane. We'll start with yesterday's program, which was a look back at Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign for the presidency. June wrote to tell us she strongly disagreed with one of our guests, political science professor Matt Dickinson, about whether or not Bernie could have had the votes to win the nomination. She says, as an election official in my town, I am furious over the level of voter suppression in the primaries. Up to 6% voting issues is normal. In Vermont, we had about 3%, but too many states saw 17% or more, which strongly points to shenanigans. You don't make large changes in the location of polls or purge voter lists in a presidential election year.
Matthew in Huntington shared these thoughts. We need to work from the bottom and elect progressive candidates from school boards to D.C. I have stopped voting for the lesser of two evils and will not vote for Hillary Clinton. Until we grow a strong third or fourth party, nothing will change.
And we heard from Linda. She writes, as a Canadian observer, I don't see anything nefarious about the DNC favoring Democratic Party member Hillary Clinton over outsider Bernie Sanders. It seems reasonable to me that for Sanders to gain the nomination, he would have had to mount a campaign on two fronts, both to party insiders and the general electorate.
Boy, I can hear some pushback to Linda coming through the radio now, Rick. And here are two contrasting points of view on VPR's coverage of Sanders. First, Val in East Burke, who says, today, listening to Vermont Edition, my blood nearly boiled as I listened to your obvious bias towards Hillary Clinton. The expert guest you had on was so very biased, and it seemed that neither of you even attempted to mask your Hillary slant.
But Nancy hears the opposite in our reporting. She writes, I have listened for the past year to the cultish coverage of Bernie Sanders' presidential run, which has gone on and on and on. His delegates have no knowledge of how the democratic process is supposed to work and are behaving like thugs. But this morning, your endless flattery keeps coming. You have lost perspective, and it is time to shut it off.
Okay, switching topics. Last week, we spoke with Vermont Gas President and CEO Don Rendell about the natural gas pipeline running to Addison County. One point of contention is whether or not the Public Service Board will let Vermont Gas tap into money in the so-called SURF fund to offset the cost of construction. If not, rates for current Vermont gas customers could increase substantially this fall. Rendell demurred, though, when I asked him to address that possibility. If the Public Service Board denies your request, though, will rates increase by 13%?
Well, I don't want to talk in hypotheticals, Jane.
But that's what you've put out there, right? That without approval for that, you would have to raise rates at least temporarily by 13%. I mean, that's not my hypothetical.
Well, as I said, the we can be confident. I'm very confident that when our rate process is complete, that customers will not see a rate increase because we didn't ask for one.
One listener, Mark, took issue with Rendell's comment. He writes, Rendell doesn't want to talk in hypotheticals regarding rate increases, but if he's assuming approval of SURF monies to prevent a 13% rate increase, then that in itself is a hypothetical assumption. Give me a break. What a hypocrite.
Well, we love to hear your comments, whatever they may be. So keep them coming on our Vermont Edition Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Vermont Edition. Rick, thank you.
You're welcome, Jane.
Okay, make sure you're with us tomorrow for Vermont Edition. VPR is releasing the results of an election poll we just conducted, and we'll dive into the results on tomorrow's program. We'll look at what Vermonters think of the candidates running for statewide office, whether Bernie supporters are moving to Hillary, and what people think about issues like water quality, refugee resettlement, and marijuana legalization. Send your thoughts or questions to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us tomorrow live at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Jake Burstein. Mary Williams directed the show, our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.